Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Saying, man,
yeah, good. I sort of need a piss.
Yeah, I do as well. Well, yeah. Look, should we do the intro then piss and then we can get into it?
Yeah.
Nice. What's that little army sort of vibe you're wearing?
Well, yeah, it's Bape
army. Yeah.
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 What is that, a sort of walking? Police.
Yeah, it's called North Face, yeah. Mate.
Are you like a rowing teacher or something? I don't know.
Rowing teacher on a cold, yeah. Sunday.
Yeah. Same cap as yesterday.
Nice, yeah. Is that it? What's that? Like a dad baseball cap?
Yeah.
But like, yeah. I don't mean like the new modern dad ones. I mean like a fat dad that's into American football.
Yeah. 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 Well, you know, in maybe sort of 6 months to a year when you'll start wearing them. Because funny that, because I wore Dunks. I started wearing Dunks again probably about, I don't know, let's say a year and a half ago. Yeah. And you ripped the shit out of me.
Yeah, and I still never wear them.
No, I know, but it seems like half the world's wearing them.
Yeah, because they're all morons.
Yeah. Well,
anyway, sometimes you make a good choice and sometimes it's just...
No.
It never kicks off.
Are the TNs still?
Yeah. Still pretty worn in.
Yeah, that's good to know, man. Good. I hope they're comfy.
Yeah. Someone that doesn't need to wear TNs is our next guest, because he's so rich, he wears probably Gucci.
Gucci, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Like Prada shoes, trainers,
Fendi,
whatever.
Louis. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Today's guest is someone very special. Someone who's quite literally the reason behind the greatest TV show known to man being commissioned and put on telly.
The Office.
That and People Just Do Nothing.
Oh, yeah.
A man who's been with us since the start of our journey. Mm. The exec producer's favourite exec producer. The man of immaculate comedic taste.
Yes.
The legendary, living, breathing telly icon, Ash Atala.
Burskept.
Churbash.
Be sure to shout.
Welcome. Make sure you take your shoes off at the door. Because I've just got the cleaner in. And she costs 20 quid an hour. And time is money. And money is mine.
How you doing, mate?
I'm good. I feel excited and vulnerable to be in your hands.
Yeah.
Good. And I don't mind that.
The best things always start like that.
Yeah, I feel wide open for you, boys.
That's all I ever want to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From anyone.
How you're going to see a different version of me today, aren't you? Where I'm trying to be slightly organizing serious talk sort of vibes.
I mean, if I see any level of preparation, I'll be fucking blown away.
Oh, wow. You are going to be blown away.
I really am.
I've done a case file on you.
Yeah. Before every podcast, Sipa does a case file.
Hugo doesn't read them. And then we just sort of freestyle in the end.
Oh, mate, how long did you spend Googling somebody you've worked with for 6 years?
Good 45.
Most of it, I knew. There was a few little bits, though. There was a few little surprising bits. I didn't know that you used to be a co-presenter. I didn't know you started as a presenter.
Yeah. I did some, you know, the sort of arrogance of youth. When I started writing to the BBC, instead of going, I'd like to work in TV, I sort of said, I'd like my own chat show. and then I got pissed off when they didn't send me one in return.
What a letter, you mean?
Yeah, just sort of a letter going, Graham Norton's down this week. Do you want to come and do it, Ash? Sort of thing.
We've never met you, but we really loved your vibe for how you wrote.
Bring him in.
Really nice. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you just sound like a massive, overly confident 22-year-old. Come and do a show.
Yeah. Is that when you first started sort of thinking about trying to get into the industry, just by sending letters?
I did just send letters. I was working in a bank. I was a trainee stockbroker.
Wow.
I just wasn't that good at it, but it was what I always wanted to do. So I sometimes say that I resigned, but the truth is, what's the other one?
It's when... Fired?
You get fired. Fired?
Yeah.
Fired?
Yeah. It happens to us. Yeah. It happens.
What's the one where you say, I'm leaving, and they go, you're carrying that then. Side?
Yeah.
What's that one?
What's the one where you say, I quit, and they go, no, you're fired. What do you mean you quit? No, I quit.
You're already halfway down the M3. Fuck off home.
Yeah.
Who's that one? I did start writing to the BBC, and I didn't really know what working in television meant. I didn't really look into it. I was poorly researched. And I just started writing to some sort of famous names I saw on the end of programs. And and most people didn't reply. But, you know, I just kept telling them that I was in a wheelchair, and if they didn't reply, I was going to kill myself. And then what would...
That's a good angle.
And to people that don't know about Ash, he's not even in a wheelchair.
I'm not even in a wheelchair. Not only Leggy am I not in a wheelchair, but as you can see from the Zoom, I can float.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, but we'll get back to, I guess we'll get back to the beginning of your journey in a bit. Okay. But how's present day? How have you... I know we talk, so we just got to pretend that we don't know. But how's lockdown been for you? And have you spent the last year and a half, I guess?
Sometimes I sort of career between two extremes of... in a quite zen-like mode. I'm hardly drinking, so I've hardly been drinking in the last year. Mm-hmm. So I've just been sort of keeping calm and trying to lose a bit of weight and just sort of staying in some sort of better mental state zone, as you'll know.
Looking fresh.
I'm looking fresh, man. As you'll know, I don't mind a drink and a bit of chaos in life, but that doesn't go well with being indoors for a year. So I'm
I thought you said a bit of K. Then a bit of ketamine and a drink. I love it.
Well, I'm on K now.
That's how you're floating.
Aren't you? Yeah.
Always.
I actually feel fitter and really well.
That's good.
So I feel good. And then my work in terms of we get a lot of script development done. You know, so I'm literally sitting in front of Zooms like all day long. So you're not going to believe this, but this is actually a nice one.
Yeah,
you know, I'm actually enjoying Thank this you. Already. Yeah. Can you imagine? Imagine the others.
Yeah.
This is honestly true. Not only was I happy to say yes when you asked me, I was a bit like, why the fuck haven't they asked me yet? I was
like, yeah, so relieved. Oh, thank God. Okay, yes.
I made them.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't even get on that one.
After this, you'll be on loads of them. Your Zooms will be out of control.
Yeah. I can relate, though. But last year, I sort of indulged, and because I got COVID pretty early on and sort of was tired off the back of it and stuff like that. But this year, since the beginning of the year, I've done the same, man. No drinking, working out a bit more, and I feel a lot better as well, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Same.
I just think you as well, Hugo.
Yeah, yeah. I just hit the gym hard sort of after the first lockdown lifted and it's been eating right.
I just think, you know, there are moments where you kind of go, I'm going to get some people around to my house and like get bottles of vodka out. And actually, the best thing is to just surrender yourself to it.
Yeah.
And let this be a little moment in life.
Yeah.
And but fucking hell, God help you when this all opens up, because I'm gonna be fornicating in the street with anyone.
Just wanking at walls.
I'm just gonna be wanking into bin men.
Not wanking even bins, in an Uber.
Yeah.
Bin men.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, see you in the spring.
This is a very useful part of the show for when you need things to do. It's the recommendation part.
Being someone that knows a little bit about telly and, yeah, and the industry, have you been watching any things or listening or reading anything that you can sort of recommend?
Anything tickled you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've watched what some might describe as an obscene amount of TV. I've sort of watched everything. That joke where people have been saying they've completed TV, I'm pretty close. Just, I probably think my favourite thing has been The Boys on
Amazon. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah.
I gave that half an episode and I just gave up, but maybe I should stick to it.
I'm not a superhero man at all, actually. I don't really go for those kind of shows, but it's so pin sharp and pretty dark in places. And you know, it's all about the writing, chaps, as you know.
Mm.
And the writing is pretty extraordinary in places. So that's my favorite thing I've seen.
I'm glad that you said you're not a superhero man, because now we'll watch it, because I'm not either. But you always need someone to tell you that it's not really my thing. Usually, but this is amazing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, push through the capes.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
The flying.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What's that you're drinking there, Hugo? I've got a little ginger tea here.
Oh, what nice. I've got a little green tea.
I've got a Coke Zero.
Well done, everyone.
It's not second round. I'm sorry.
Really great drinks.
Yeah.
Really great drinks.
So let's take it back then. So I didn't know the stuff about you working in banking.
Yeah, same.
And you were born in Egypt, right?
Yes. Yeah, born in Egypt. And then what happened was I carelessly got polio when I was a child. They told me not to, but I wouldn't listen.
Yeah. I want to try it.
I'm just going this direction now, Dad.
Yeah.
And my parents moved to England, to the UK, to essentially to look after me a bit better, because you've seen Coming to America, or is it Trading Places, where Eddie Murphy's begging on a skateboard?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that would have been my life in Cairo.
Yeah. Fuck out. You done well out of it then, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
This new life. Jesus, you
really
made the most
turned
of it
around.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have made people just do nothing in Cairo, would I?
No.
Yalla Osama, do nothing.
You know, do you know what? Have you seen Rami on Amazon Prime? Their Egyptian family.
Really,
yeah.
Yeah, really Egyptian. Yeah, it's really great. And so we moved here, and I was brought up in a combination of Northern Ireland, because my dad went to work there. He's a doctor, he's a surgeon. And my mum's a doctor as well. So I was brought up a little bit between Northern Ireland and then we moved to England.
What age was that?
So my dad managed to take us to Northern Ireland during the Troubles. So we basically moved into a war.
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
A bit of character building.
Whereabouts, Hugo? Just into the middle of the war in Belfast.
Lovely. Nice. Lovely.
Yeah.
I have family in Northern Ireland.
Do you?
Yeah. I did something really bad because I didn't know when I was younger. And a military truck was going past. And I saluted them, and all my cousins were like, "What the fuck are you doing? Like, we need to go home now." And I didn't really understand. I do now, but
spoil little Londoner, like,
the army salute them.
Yeah,
funny.
And they used to check under my. I sort of got memories of going into like department stores with mum and dad when I was about 10, and they would check under my wheelchair for bombs.
Wow.
You know, those sort of machines that they check under cars.
Yeah.
Just suppose it would be a pretty sensible place, because what, you know, what else has he got to lose? Stick a bomb under him. So,
yeah,
so
that, just so, left with, oh, not the arms as well.
But he's sitting on it. No, there's something in suicide bombing. I think it's going to be popular.
Not the arms. Never them. So that was it. And then I think basically I was always trying to, well, my dad was always trying to think of jobs for me that I could do easily sort of sitting down. So when you boys are probably a little bit young for this, but sort of when the big bang in the city came and Margaret Thatcher and sort of when your window cleaner and plumber would come back a year later and go, oh yeah, I made £4 million as a stockbroker in the city in the 80s. And then my dad just went, well, why don't you do that, Ash? So I thought, well, why don't I do that? But we both overlooked one thing, which was I'm shit at maths. So that's what happened. So I went into that and it went, and jokes aside, it was a disaster. And then so I was left at about 24 without, you know, and that was the big thing that I built up to be doing my whole sort of university career, was working in the city. And then when that didn't work out, I was sort of left with a gap, otherwise known as the future.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and it's comforting to know as well that it wasn't just like, you know, at 18, I got a job and it was amazing. You know what I mean? It was
like,
good that there's a bit of a journey there. And because, like, we never know, you know, same with us. I never know I wanted to be an actor. It wasn't until I was like 26 that I met you. Do you know what I mean? And something changed there. But before that was work-wise, but what things you were into and stuff like that, like the stuff that created your comedic taste or your taste for like TV and film and stuff like that, where did that come from?
I think I was always into comedy, and I was, you know, not the class clown, but I was always sort of aware that you had to, you know, I was in a very weird, you know, to go back to that Northern Ireland thing, you know, I was a brown boy, I'm Egyptian, so I'm brown. And in a wheelchair, and then I had this really mad Northern Irish accent. So when I opened my mouth, like, nothing fitted. Everything,
you
know,
sort of Egyptian.
It's like Egyptian. Irish. I go, how are you? And it's like, what the fuck is? It's like, so nothing really sort of came together when you looked at me. It was all like three different people rolled into one mistake, and so I sort of had to. I think the truth is I had to sort of find a way to make people sort of take a bit of notice of me, maybe. And maybe that's why I started talking too much at like 9 years old and haven't really stopped. And I think just trying to make people laugh and trying to have a modicum of charm was something.
You're a very charming man, Ash.
Well, you're very sweet. You're very kind. And that was, I think, just a bit of an armor that I sort of tried to develop
That makes sense.
You know, because we all worry about falling down the cracks, don't we? That's the thing. Sort of
especially young and in school, like,
yeah, man,
you never want to be the sort of a target.
Yeah,
yeah, or invisible. Invisible.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you want to have something to bring to the table. Yeah, exactly. True. Yeah, for sure.
The weird balance.
That's worse. Being invisible is worse than being, like, you know, a target or whatever, I guess.
Mm. I mean, being bullied is horrible, but, like, if nobody even notices you enough to bully you, that's even worse.
Yeah. Like, you guys, a famous story about the house party and the girl.
Oh, yeah, there was just a girl in my class, and she had a house party. She was really popular, and I went to a house party, and then the week after, she was like, I had a house party the weekend. I was like, yeah, I was there. And she's like, yeah. Like, yeah, I was there. Like, I thought I killed it that night.
It's the ghost of the party.
Yeah.
So funny.
Who fucks that guy?
I remember when I was when I was younger, I went to a disabled school, and they used to get the sort of people, the kids from the school next door to us. They used to come and help us out, and it was like they would be like doing good to come and help the disabled kids at the school next door. And one of the girls from the normal school was called Karen, and I asked her out. I swear to God, she had to sit down. She was laughing so hard, and I was like, "She's like, no." Yeah. She literally looked at me like, obviously not.
Oh my God, Jesus Christ!
So that's the sort of shit that
it's
drives
not a weird
you.
Question
isn't it?
Coming from me, is it, Karen? Of course, I want to have sex with you. Why is that weird coming from me?
Also, why is it funny, Karen?
Yeah, why is it funny? Yeah.
Karen, I hope she's watching this now.
Yeah,
Karen.
Yeah,
exactly.
Karen.
Right, working three jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Zach is on Zoom in an art gallery. He lives in.
So Ash, so where did the I guess maybe you've answered that in the sense of maybe that gave you this resilience and confidence with the things you've been through and how your life is sort of put together, I guess. But having the sort of audacity almost to be writing these letters, then where did that even come from?
Yeah, that is true. I look back on it now with a sort of mixture of, well, thank God I did, but also what was I thinking? Yeah. I tell you where I showed the most absurd level of audacity. To cut a long story short, I ended up getting a traineeship at the BBC, and sort of again, I got fired out of incompetence. Do you remember Carol Vorderman? Carol Vorderman.
Yeah.
She's still around. I ended up being her researcher on a program, and I got on really well. She said to me, "Ash, you're very funny. You should be in the comedy department." And I was like, "Yeah, I really agree with that, Carol Vorderman." always called her by two names. Yeah. And she sort of helped me. Her and another lady called Claire Pisey at the BBC helped me get a traineeship at the comedy department. And on day one, I think, and that's where I met Stephen Merchant. And I sort of joined this show. And I think, because I was so junior and young, this is a wheelchair, inverted commas, joke, but this is absolutely true. I think they thought I should be a runner on a show. And I turned up on day one. I don't think they had been told that I was in a wheelchair. I think they just thought, it's gonna take him a long time to bring back teas and coffees. it's like, these are all cold.
Now I'm coming.
On a perpetual run going back to get hot ones.
Yeah. I quite like the thought of you having that job, but then being like, it's fine, and they're all running around you and you're just relaxing.
Yeah.
If you talk to Stephen Merchant about this, he's absolutely fucking furious because he had to run around doing the actual, he had to get props, costumes for actors and stuff. And they put me at a desk with a big pile of scripts to read because they didn't know what else to do with me. And
that must have been incredible for having that, being able to be at that position.
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't, and it was right in the heart of BBC comedy. And honestly, Dawn French walked by me in the corridor. I was like, this is actually where they are. The famous people. This is on, I suppose, I didn't realize you have to work, famous people have to work in a room at some point.
Yeah, they exist.
I'm in that room.
They probably get a hotel upstairs where they all live.
Probably, but they wouldn't let me in that one. And then I just had that pile of scripts on my desk and they didn't know what to do. And I picked up a pen and started editing them. Which, when I look back, that is arrogance, stupidity. But I just
confident.
Thought, I just started making cuts in the scripts and writing new jokes, and they were like,
"This runner has changed." It's cut
just,
loads of it.
Just
up.
A massive cross with the word wrong.
Wrong.
No.
Yeah.
Even cold coffee would be better from this bloke, but this is too much. So that's how I began.
What the hell was Stephen Merchant doing there? Was he also just doing some behind the scenes stuff?
He was driving, the show was called Comedy Nation and it was a sketch show, late night BBC.
Yeah, I think I know that, yeah. Sketch show.
Funny enough, it's sort of where Sacha Baron Cohen started a little bit. He did a couple of characters on there and it was Sally Phillips had some bits. So he was driving the actors to locations to film sketches and stage driving, and I was back at the BBC writing script notes.
That's so sick. That's amazing. So where did you being a presenter come from? It's for a show called Freak Out, right?
Yes, there was a show called Freak Out. Well, I told you I'd been working in the BBC comedy department for about 9 minutes and conquered that.
Yeah.
So I just thought, what should I do now? Presumably the British people want me to be on TV, not just behind the camera.
Yeah, they're begging for it.
They valued it so much.
And that got tedious. So I thought, all right, I'll do it. And then Channel 4, there was a program called Rapido that was on in the 90s. It was like a late night, naughty look at the world, and they wanted to do a disabled version of that,
of course.
And as one of the UK's most prominent disabled people. there's a competition you don't want to win. they asked me to co-present it with a guy called Matt Fraser, and I kind of enjoyed it, but then also looked back on it, as in watched it and thought, not that good at that either, really. So I thought I'd go back to producing, also because of the will of the people.
Yeah. They spoke both times and you listened.
And I answered the call.
Yeah.
There was a little talk and you went back to producing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So from I'm thinking timescales wise, like from that to the idea of The Office being brought to you, like, you know, talk us through that.
So this is all happening concurrently, really. And I've met Stephen Merchant when I was on the late night sketch show, and he showed me a clip of his mate Ricky Gervais doing a character that was then called Sleazy Boss, which was sort of Gervais just looking at women and going,
yeah, like in the bit where you charmed me.
You have charmed me.
Yeah.
Exploring Europe and yourself. Yeah. So it was quite one dimensional. I mean, I thought it was brilliant. It was just the guy being sleazy. I thought, well, I could watch years of this.
Yeah.
let's put it straight out on BBC One from where I'm sitting. But then we just began to, that was, and then sort of Stephen had sort of come to the end of his traineeship, and he really wanted to be a writer. And I was sort of going down the producing road by then. And then we sort of made this semi-pact that I would try and help. You know, the thing is, I didn't really have any influence. But, you know, I was sort of, I watched that Office taste of tape that him and Ricky had made, and I was just very convinced that there was really something in it.
Did you have a feeling when you saw it that this is something special?
Yeah, because when people ask me that, I sort of have two answers, because the non-wanker answer is, it's hard to tell, who knows. And, but in the case of The Office, and another time I've had the strength of feeling is when I saw The People Just Do Nothing early tapes as well. I had this, I always think it's sort of like this religious calling that this thing is really good. I can't really explain it. It's like a certainty. The thing is, you don't want to be the boy who cries wolf, because so you can't be certain about everything.
Yeah. Well, you said that about the last thing, mate. No, but this time.
So you've got to pick your moments in this business when you sort of go thing, and then if you get it right a couple of times, then people will listen. And if you have a run of getting it wrong, people will go, you know, just take out the bins and don't keep calling me. So I had it then.
Yeah, I guess that's the danger though, isn't it? Like you say, picking those moments, and that was a massive gamble with that, because I mean, these days, you know, people try out loads of different things, whatever, but like back then when it was like a comedy climate of like laughter tracks and, you know, no like sort of dry comedy without gags and in a documentary format, like I guess like people didn't want to commission it at first or whatever.
And
it was a bit
weird. And you'll know from our journey with People Just Do Nothing, it's not enough to just have me or you or anyone say, we think this is great.
Yeah.
You then got to navigate a very long, precarious political road with loads of banana skins. And there are loads of moments when any project, The Office, People Just Do Nothing, any project could just fall down the back of the sofa. It can just go, all moments where a project sort of takes flight and sort of ignites a little bit. And, you know, The Office had several sort of, you know, 50-50 moments, and I can think of various meetings where, you know, it's basically people sitting around a table and one person, you know, if you imagine it's sort of like a seesaw, and somebody says something, go, oh, we're going to do a pilot, and somebody goes, oh, it's a little bit slow, oh, we're not going to do a pilot. And it's literally like one of those meetings, and eventually they sort of said, let's do a pilot, and the pilot was good enough. I mean, look, Ricky and Stephen, you know, the other thing about my job is work with clever people, you know, a cliche about work with people who make you look good. And, you know, they're clearly extraordinary talents, as are you.
I was going to say, it's embarrassing.
When people say...
Staring in your eyes, squinting, nodding along violently.
They say, Merchant Gervais, Mustafa. Yeah.
Mustafa.
Segwig. They spell his name wrong.
Segwig.
That's, yeah.
And because even me, I mean, you know what a massive fan I am of The Office. I've stolen everything from there. But, but like, you know, even me being such a massive Office fan, and it's even changed, it's with me and all our friends, you'll notice it's changed our sort of the language, the way we talk to each other and everything is such a massive thing in our lives. But the first time I saw it, and I was like maybe 16, and when it was on the telly, I didn't get it.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I just thought it was some boring documentary.
I thought that Gareth was really funny, but I didn't understand it.
Yeah. And then a few years later, come back to it, and it's like a life-changing thing that happened to us.
Yeah.
I think there really is, it was a moment with that show whereby, you know, it could have also not caught fire. And that's after we made it, by the way. I mean, so we had made it, and actually The Office is pretty slow. You know, I think its biggest sort of hurdle, in a sense, is pretty slow and it's pretty quiet. And, you know, when a footballer does a penalty and sometimes they just shoot it straight down the middle, and when it goes in, they look clever. And when it hits the goalie, you look like an idiot. I sort of always thought the same about The Office, which is like, because it worked, we look good. But we could have easily just hit the goalie. And by that, I mean, it's just a bit slow and nothing happened.
Yeah.
And of course it didn't work. It's boring. I mean, that's the whole point. But because it worked, it sort of, we've in a sense, got away with it. But you look back in that moment and, you know, the ratings were very slow to pick up. And
were they?
Yeah, it was a real slow burn.
Was there a moment in it that kind of like propelled it into the massive show that it is now, like the dance or those sort of things?
They were very clever. They repeated it just in time to be considered for the BAFTAs. And so it was on in the summer and was getting a little bit of buzz, but like really low level buzz. And then you guys will know, because you've won one, the BAFTAs are, people sit down to sort of do their BAFTA chats in January, Feb.
Right.
And the head of BBC Two, she repeated The Office in January, Feb.
Okay.
So it was right on again. And this time, momentum. And then we got nominated for a BAFTA and won. And that was the moment.
And that's it, right. Yeah. But it's interesting you say that, because... obviously, we work in the industry, but we've got a lot of shit munchers that listen to this podcast, Ash. And it's interesting to know that like, even scheduling politics is a massive thing in these things. You know, making sure that people actually see this show. You know what I mean? It's not just making a good show.
There are so many... you know, when you have a hit show, it sort of means that almost everything has gone right, because, you know, you guys will also know that it's a game of Jenga. And you can have a really good show and... the fourth character in it is just a bad actor and everything's fucked. So I think you sort of need almost a perfect storm. Like you sort of need nothing to go wrong for a show to really work.
Moment.
You need luck, you need stars aligning, you need quality, and you need to not make a mistake. And it's hard not to make a mistake when making a TV show, because there's like 1,000 decisions you make. And one of them incorrect can tip it all. Any step of the way, yeah.
For me, The Office is a perfect, it's the perfect comedy, like, for me. All the characters are amazing, it's believable, it's painful to watch.
Yeah, it's
relatable.
It's art as well as, you know what I mean? It's not just comedies for comedy's sake, it's kind of saying something and it's making you feel a certain way.
It's a journey.
And also, you guys will also understand this. It's to do with casting. For example, you've got all the main people, but let's say you've got a postman walking in to deliver some mail to Wernham Hogg. That guy needs to be a really good actor. He can't come and go, "Hello, it's your letter."
trying to be the comedy actor himself. Yeah. All the essays in The Office, I've never seen anything like in comedy. Any essay, essay is a supporting artist. You know, they used to be called extras, to anyone that doesn't know. They just play the role so well.
Well, I can take credit for that, because what I figured out that we've sort of figured out, if you're shooting an office, you're shooting a room, you've got five or six main characters, You know, Tim, Dawn, you know who they are. And then you kind of go, well, actually, the office is going to have like 10 people, 15 people in it. So the people who are in the background are going to be in vision all the time. And that's where we could really get it wrong. And actually, you also need your main cast interacting with everyone. Otherwise, it looks like you've got this sealed off office.
Yeah.
And then the people who are sitting next to them, just behind them, aren't in the same show.
Yeah.
So we figured out it's got to feel fluid. And what we did was we sort of realized that we were auditioning people for parts. And then we kind of thought, if they don't get one of the main parts, but they're still really good, would they mind sitting in the background? And then that became difficult as we're sort of saying to actual actors, do you sort of mind playing an extra? And I worked out the amount of money that you would have to pay an extra to come. Because don't forget, as you all know, extras, you hire them for certain days.
Yeah.
But in the office, we needed them every day.
Yeah.
Because they're always in shot.
Yeah, well, they're essentially characters, aren't they? They're part of the furniture there.
Came Big Keith and came.
Yeah.
So none of those were actually written pieces.
Okay.
They were just like, we sort of cast actors who sort of looked unusual because Ricky and Steven said, well, most people who work in offices, we're just a mongrel group of people thrown together under one roof.
Yeah.
And so that's how that all came about.
Yeah, and even the reactions, even like, you know, it'd be easy for someone to do something stupid that's, you know, or trying to tell a stupid joke, like Brent trying to tell a stupid joke. And, you know, in real life, no one just looks away and goes silent. They do like an awkward laugh or you know what I mean? And that was like one of the first shows I ever saw that included that, you know, the reactions of these people were so real. Like you say, like real actors.
Well, if you think about what you see in an office, somebody sort of answers a phone, yawns, stretches, says a couple of words and puts the phone down. It's actually very hard to get that to look real. That's what I mean by those details. If they looked unbelievable, the show begins to fall apart.
Yeah. What was the vibe like? You know, like when you see all these online, you know, like on YouTube, you'll see the extras of The Office with like Ricky Gervais fucking around doing loads of different takes. Was it a fun vibe for everyone, or was that just him like overindulging in that and people freaking out in the background?
It was logistically, technically a very simple show because we hardly left that room.
Yeah. So,
you know how in People Just Do Nothing and in all shows, we're often like against the clock. It's like, hurry up.
We're having to get changed 10 times a day and shit.
This show, we were like done by 2 p.m. we finished the pages for today.
And that's with him fucking around as well.
That's with him fucking around. So Ricky's always had this, I don't think he'll ever work. He doesn't like, you know, you normally have to wake up at 5 a.m., be on set at 6, have breakfast at 6:15. Yeah. Ricky's like, fuck that. And he takes a few hours.
Yeah.
So it really was. And then sort of Martin Freeman is a funny fucker in real life as well.
Right,
on set, it really was a joyous atmosphere. It really was.
That's amazing. That's amazing to know.
You can tell as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And who would have known as you were watching that you'd end up entirely copying it and also having a success?
I know. Yeah. And trying to fuck about just as much. Like, in our minds, he didn't even only lay the blueprint of what the show looks like. It's the process of fucking around as much as you can as well.
That's the best bit.
Yeah. Were you watching it with a notepad? What happened? You tell me what happened.
Yeah. That's basically, it was just days of us just watching The Office and watching the bloopers, like every day for years, and communicating with each other like that as well. And always shutting each other down and being, you know, more arrogant than the other. But to the point where it sometimes caused me problems in relationships. Sorry, stop talking like that. Yep, got it. Yeah.
The Brentisms. Really, it's very addictive.
It is.
Rhythm of speech, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and you feel like it's your little secret club until you realise there's loads of wankers everywhere.
Everyone,
I sort of couldn't believe it when I saw the People Just Do Nothing tape as well, because it was obviously so... There was so much DNA in it from The Office, and it was also so completely its own thing. So you ripped it off and completely redid it as
like
well.
Both. David Brent, like two, maybe three David Brents in a pirate radio station.
Yeah, pretty much. But, you know, and as much as, you know, I hold my hands up to that, of course. But at the same time, you're right, Ashley, you have to be inspired by something as well. And when something takes that much of a hold of you, I'm sure there's music artists it happens to, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just something that inspires you so much that you can't actually tear yourself away from it until you start, I guess, you know, developing it and bringing your own thing to it. Sort of it
becomes like a sub-genre, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, in a way, yeah. That sort of mockumentary, faux arrogant format.
Mm.
Completely. And The Office doesn't have a TM on that. And actually, to the credit of People Just Do Nothing, you rarely hear people say it ripped off The Office. I actually thought with my involvement in both shows, I thought I would get that a lot more.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I just don't.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, yo!
Yo!
Ha ha!
Ha 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 ha!
Will everybody shut the fuck up?
Settle down, settle down!
You're in tune to the Chatting Shit Podcast!
UK stand up!
The world's greatest!
The best there ever was that ever lived!
Series 2 out now, motherfucker!
Oh gosh!
Ha ha!
Are you ready?
Check it! Check
Are
it!
You ready?
Check it! After that, it would have been IT Crowd would have been the next big hit, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So and you starred in that as well.
Yeah.
One episode. I always remember that's where I first saw you.
Did you feel the people calling for that again?
Yeah, you know what it's like when the United Kingdom get on the phone and they say,
yeah.
Do you want to be in your own show again?
I'm waiting for it, but I can't wait when it happens.
The Nation was like, this hasn't been anything as good since Freak Out back in the day. I need this guy on my screen.
We need him back.
Graham Linehan wrote this. I remember reading that episode of the IT Crowd, and he said, but I mean, the whole episode was about people in wheelchairs going to the theatre. And
made perfect sense, really.
There's a bit in it where it's just like there's a gay mustachioed Egyptian in a wheelchair in the coach, and I was like, wow,
he's pretty much ticked most of those boxes.
Yeah, I'll see who I can get.
He puts it in front of you, Egyptian. Yeah, oh, that's embarrassing. He's like, what?
And he goes,
well, I'm Egyptian. Are you? Oh, for fuck. Yes, I'm Egyptian.
Yes, I am. He said, no, I've already given the part to Mustafa.
Oh man, and so how did that come about? How did the IT crowd come about? You obviously people were talking about your name. You had a bit of success off the back of The Office, right?
That's right. And Graham Linehan, you know, when a show goes well, as you'll know, you get a few sort of new friends. Jonathan Ross and Graham Linehan became friends of the show. Jonathan Ross had a real bromance.
I remember that time.
From podcasts.
Yeah, I remember from radio shows, Ricky saying Jonathan's walking through with his dick out.
Yeah.
they were always playing tennis together.
Yeah, right.
That's how you know they were mates.
Yeah.
didn't invite me to that, did they? And then Graham Linehan had just done Father Ted. And he started talking to me about, you know, I think the IT Crowd was originally set in a travel agents. And we began working on that. I think at that point, sort of my career sort of began sort of growing in a few different directions. I think we're sort of just capitalizing on that moment of the office, and all I ever felt was sort of anxious to do the next thing. Yeah. You know, I just think I just remember like really good friends of mine saying, almost in a mocking way, well, like, what are you going to do now? Like, and I just, there's a real pleasure that people take in that moment. Mm. And I was like, well, first of all, if the office is the only thing that I ever do that makes it, I'll take it. You know, that's all right.
Yeah.
But second of all, you know, you never feel, there's never a champagne moment, is there? There's never a moment where you just feel, you know, arrived or successful or nothing like that.
Yeah.
I only ever feel fear.
I agree. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. Well, actually, interestingly, that makes me think, I've never asked you this, but classically, The Office did 2 series and a Christmas special, you know, six episodes per series as well. Did you ever think to do more?
I wanted to do more at the time. I was a real advocate for a third series.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I was with people just do nothing, always wanted. There was a talk, wasn't there, around series 4 of that being in the air. I think sort of now that I'm a bit older, I know how hard it is to have shows that work. And so now I'm very much, let's flog them to fucking death.
Let's make the most out of this.
Yeah, I'm not going to start this all again with something new. We've just got something. Yeah.
It's rolling now.
Yeah.
And people go, well, people just do nothing. It's going off the ball. And I go, you ain't seen nothing like off the ball yet. You wait, I'll show you off the boil. We've got 8 more series to do.
We've signed a trilogy.
So I did think maybe The Office had ended a touch prematurely. And that's the engine that sends you into new stuff.
Yeah. Which was IT Crowd, right? Was that the thing straight after that?
Yeah, did the IT Crowd. And then it sort of had funny, the IT Crowd is really, one of those shows that has sort of stayed around. I've got mates now who tell me they show it to their children, and it's very kids like. I tried to show it to my daughter, she's 7, and she's still too young for it. She didn't think she said it was shit, but the IT Crowd has aged well. I mean, it looks old fashioned, but it's aged quite well.
Yeah, well, there's a warmth to it, isn't there?
So, yeah.
It's good for repeats, you can watch that one again.
It's always on
cashback,
yeah.
Bumps.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to the most important bit, obviously.
Let's get to it. Come on.
This is going to be interesting because we always talk about our perspective on how it all came about. But I really want to hear your, you know, and sometimes I hear a few lines for you when we're on stage, you know, fucking about. But like, your honest the view on how it all went down. How and when did you first hear about, because for anyone listening, we did, obviously People Just Do Nothing was like a little bit of a YouTube series, but real like low level. We only had a couple of webisodes out, and Ash has a production company called Rough Cut, and they got in touch with us, so that's all we knew. But tell us your perspective.
So I have to, in just at the very inception, mention two things that happened. John Petrie, I think, was in touch with Asim. Yeah. So I think Asim had been in touch with it. And then a friend of mine called Mark Whelan, who, and I remember it really clearly, he called me up and he said, I've seen something YouTube that is right up your street. And I remember almost sort of searching it while he was on the phone, my computer in front of me, and I just looked it up and I found it and I said, okay, I'll give it a watch. And I pretty much put the phone down and just watched it. And I don't always do that. People are always telling me, watch this, read this, and I just did it straight away. And I was like, I really loved it. And I called John in. He was like, Rough Cut was a lot smaller back then. I called John in, and he said, "Yeah, I think I'm also in touch with one of those blokes." And do you know what? I really did get excited by it very early on, and then I got much less excited by it when I met you all. Because I remember feeling fucking bewildered by you all, and
describe what happened from your perspective.
Okay, all right. So I said to ask John to see if you would all come in for a meeting. So let's just go to that bit. You all agreed to come in for a meeting, and Rough Cut have got this. We've got a front door and a lift where people come in. We've also got this sort of back entrance that where people come in, it often looks like I always feel that we're being robbed. So I remember looking up from my desk and there were six of you at the back entrance and I thought we were being robbed because you wear tracksuits and that's what burglars wear. And you all came in and my memory of it goes something like this. You all sat down and I think one or two of you just said you were sort of huge fans of The Office. And I just thought, well, they're going to be massively pleased to be here and massively grateful. And I could not get a fucking word in edgeways in the first meeting. You did not stop talking and you have not stopped talking over me in eight years. This podcast is the most I've ever got to speak because there's only two of you I can divide and conquer. But normally when you're with all your little mates doing all your little in-jokes and you force me into the role of boring dad, me, you make me the cunt.
Yeah.
And that began in that meeting.
Yeah. And imagine how other people think, because at least you're in with 80% of those in-jokes because they're from The Office. because I remember, like, when we got that email, we're obviously, you know, some of us more than others, but a bit defensive of our little idea and, you know, we didn't want, you know, the man fucking ripping it apart and that. But then, of course, when we found out, we were like, and then when I Google him, we're like, all right, he produced The Office. It's exactly what we want. Perfect. Let's not get too excited, though. Let's still hold back a little bit. And then we met, and obviously we expected, you know, John to be this sort of blood-sucking TV producer, vampire. But he was just like the sweetest guy, and you'd produce The Office, and you know you're obviously funny and stuff. So I remember obviously being a little bit defensive and you know not picking battles and stuff, but also feeling like this felt right. Do you know what I mean?
It did, and I went straight away into from the moment of that meeting right up until sort of now, I sort of went into this kind of like I've got your back mode on it and sort of make, you know, all your fears, because I sort of, without sounding like a dick, I sort of watched it having made, I just sort of knew exactly what I felt we should do with it, and I also knew exactly what could go wrong with it, like the bad version of people just do nothing. Let's just take a moment and think of what the bad version of this show would be. It's just the most embarrassing street talk, you know.
Yeah.
And I think you guys were having another meeting with another production company and they were maybe trying to take you in a different direction. And
we can tell you why we went with you. That guy had a weird hipster moustache. So we were like, nah, not them.
Did he?
Yeah.
He had a little pedo tash, didn't he?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
What was his name? No. And also, you were also sort of, you were also, why would you know how the business works? There's no reason. Well, you know, it's such a sort of strange, convoluted business, and the process to get on television is so smoke and mirrors, really. And I sort of thought, you know, I think the thing that worried me the most in the first few meetings was the writing, you know, and like who would have the discipline to sit down and write, you know, the scripts. And I thought without that, the thing is, nobody else could write for you because it's such a specific voice.
Yeah.
And then if you guys couldn't write for yourselves beyond those sort of 6-minute YouTube things, then I couldn't see a future for it. And so that was my main concern.
God, even you explaining that is making me feel the stress you probably would have felt in the moment.
Yeah.
I just felt a bit nervous when you said that. Like, fuck yeah. What if no one can write for them? These guys.
I was just amazed that like someone in the world of TV would want to turn this into a TV show. Like, I didn't even think that we would do that anyway. Like, it was for us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know what you mean. But like, I think
but you didn't know how good it was. This is sort of a good thing. And thank fuck, because you know, I was sort of sitting there thinking, well, you know, don't tell them how good you think it is, because they might like go, well, we don't need you for that good. And then, well, no, it's not that good.
Yeah, you still need me. Yeah,
you still need me.
Yeah.
But I thought it was, you know, it's funny you saying that, Hugo. It's like, well, I don't think you guys quite realised what you had, and you're an extremely talented bunch of guys. And then it all gelled because of the
writing. I think we did it to watch it back together and sort of laugh at each other's bits, really.
Yeah, you're right, Ash, though. I feel like, that's important. Like sometimes, well, hopefully it's something special we created. Like now I can say, you know, it's not just me. So it's like, it's not arrogant if I say that.
Yeah.
We created something special. And I feel like it's good that you don't know that in the moment, because you're not overthinking it. Do you know what I mean?
Also, the question is, you know, from a producing point of view or from any point of view, it's like, this is what I've seen on this taster tape is good. Do they have the potential to get better? So, like, we always have this saying that I say, is like, have they got it in the tank? You know, like, is this the beginning, or is this the best they can be?
Yeah.
And, you know, when you watch yourselves back, I'm sure, in terms of your acting, and, you know, just the whole show, you know, how much better you all got
100%. At doing it,
how much better the writing got, how much better Rough Cut's production got, our budgets got. Yeah. You know, so you kind of go, I wrote an email to the BBC, and I sort of showed them that taste tape, and you go, imagine that this taster tape is the worst the show will ever be. You know, like if it gets better from here, and this is a really good starting point.
Yeah.
But what I didn't know in that point is like, do you guys have it in you to get better? And that's where I get lucky with you, because you did.
Yeah, but there were times where I felt like I definitely don't have this in me. Like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm actually scared.
But do you know what? Like, that seems like a theme in your life, Ash, is kind of sniffing things out and taking a risk, like the gamble. Do you know what I mean? And I guess it's important to do that in life, you know, not all the time, like you said, but it's important to take a calculated risk, I guess.
Mm. Like a stockbroker sort of thing.
Yeah, it was in you.
Yeah.
I am a real gambler, the truth is. I am a real sort of career or just, I think, in any part of my life, I get bored easily, or when things get comfortable, I need to
shake it up a bit.
Sort of shake it up a little bit. Yeah. And I think one thing probably I'm the most proud of is, if you look back at the shows, they've created a lot of stars. I sort of don't cast many stars. I don't go and work with big talent. But talent becomes big from the shows that we make together.
Definitely.
And that's, people, Chris O'Dowd, Richard Iowadi, Gervais, Mackenzie Crook,
you guys,
Jamie Dimitri, Stafflet's Flats, there's a nice now heritage of people like yourselves. And that's what, honestly, sort of keeps you young and keeps you motivated, because well, it's funny, isn't it? Because people say that famous people become a nightmare as they sort of become more successful. I think with you guys, it was just in reverse, because you were fucking almost impossible at the beginning. And
I feel like that's a defense. That's our defense mechanism as well.
You interrupted him saying nice people.
What I was saying was, you were a nightmare to begin with, and as you become more successful, you've become nicer people.
Nicer people.
Did you get that cleanly?
Yeah.
Did you record that cleanly?
Yeah.
There was no trailer. Static on that, no?
No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. I do remember when we first met you, that was a thing that you guys said. One of us, maybe me, probably said that, like, we don't want this to change. It's got to be, you know, how we want to do it, whatever. And you guys said, creatively, you'll be involved throughout the whole thing, but we just want to make this the best it can be. You know, and like you said, all the YouTube stuff was all improv. We'd never wrote anything before, you know, we'd never acted in anything before. And it was almost like training on the job, which was amazing, like invaluable, man.
You're sort of hard to work out, you guys, as a group, because there's a real professionalism to you all. Like, you sort of know your lines, and you all really sort of know comedy. I mean, see, for us, we're having a love-in. I remember going to rehearsals that you were all doing in, I think it was just off City Road, not far from King's Cross. It's probably for series two. And I remember sort of blocking out the scenes, and I remember you sort of assuming the role of director. I mean, you weren't director, there was a director there. But I still remember you giving people sort of notes on how to joke, and I could really see that you understood it all. And then you're always on set, like basics, like on time, and you know your lines and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not there every day, so maybe I'm just got a slightly rose-tinted view of it. But then in other ways, it's a very chaotic process working with you. I think it's meetings. Can we just discuss what goes on in your head whilst we're here, fuck it, let's get this out in the open. What is wrong with you dicks when it comes to meetings?
I think like you, it's we get bored quite quickly.
Yeah.
And
I always think that like in my mind, I think of something funny or something disruptive to say. And then in my mind, I go, no, don't do that. Yeah. And then the other part of mine goes, no, it's amazing. They're going to love it. Do it.
I'm going to do it. I'm not listening to what they're saying.
Bring the vibe back up. Ash will probably like this. This is probably almost like an ad lib to what he's doing.
I've just got PTSD of like memento style memory of just down the ears of me going, guys, can you just give it a minute?
Yeah.
Oh no, why am I dad? I don't want to be dad. I want to have fun.
And you're not that, like, you are obviously jokes and fun and that, but it's funny that. In a room with us, you have to take that role.
I have to take that role. I mean, at least, you know, the other sort of good thing is like, at least that's how you were in the beginning and that's exactly how you are at the end. I think I said this in the documentary, but I don't think it's in it. You know, we should mention, shouldn't we, guys, that we've made a film together.
We have made a film.
Yeah.
We've made a film together. People Just Do Nothing Big in Japan.
Yeah.
Out this summer. We should absolutely plug it. It's a very good film. I remember the head of Universal, the head of Focus Features, and I really wanted for you guys, because most of your interaction with the film is me, and I'd be like, well, we've done this, you know. It's like I wanted us all to have that kind of movie experience. Mm-hmm. And I sort of said to the guy who runs Focus Features, you know, it's been, hey, actually, why don't I bring the boys in to your place? You know, let's do the whole boardroom, get all the marketing people, fresh croissants, tons of coffee.
Yeah.
Let's do
love
this.
That shit. Yeah.
Present to the boys.
Yeah.
And we sort of did that. You'll remember it was like a 10-foot board table, the full sort of Hollywood treatment. And about 3 minutes into that, you start talking over him. You start like passing shit around and like not looking up. And I'm like,
WhatsApping us.
What?
Repeating what he's saying and nodding.
Because the guys are very interested in this. Guys.
Yeah, oh my God.
No, but you know what it is?
It's now refreshing. You say it.
Actually, it's refreshing to these people. They're used to listening to them.
They do like people listening to them.
Yeah, people. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
And a lot of massive films. They don't know who we are and they're taking a massive risk.
Exactly.
I've always got a little apology. You know, you can airdrop text. Things from your iPhone to.
Yeah.
I've just got a little apology note that I airdropped in the meeting as I'm leaving.
It's just a photo of you with your thumbs up and it says, sorry.
Sorry.
I guess we should talk about the film. Fuck, man. Like, it is mad, isn't it? That, like, 2012, we had the pilot. So, 2011, fucking hell, 10 years ago, we would have come into your office and you would have said to us, you know, we just want to make this the best we can. Leave it with me and I'm going to get this on telly. That's the last thing you said. We sort of was like, yeah, sweet. But it's not like we were jobbing actors. It was like, oh my God, this is our opportunity, waiting every day for the call. Mm. It was like, sweet, if it happens, it's a bonus, you know. And it did, you know, like a few weeks later, we come into your office, you're like, yeah, we've got your pilot for the BBC. Now, 10 years later, we got a fucking 5 seasons down and yeah, man, we filmed the People Just Do Nothing film.
In Japan.
I remember the writing process. We're sitting in a room with John and everyone. So John Petrie is the producer of People Do Nothing and Ash is the exec producer. So Ash is the person, after we've sort of spoke about these things, we'll then bring it to Ash and see what he thinks. And the Japan idea was something that we were like, okay, now it does sound good, but let's just put that on a back burner because we've got to give Ash a serious suggestion. This isn't just us wanting a holiday in Japan. Do you know what I mean? And we were like, yeah. And every idea we're coming, we're like, yeah, maybe they're at a festival. And we're like, yeah, that would be a festival in Japan would be better, wouldn't it? Yeah, it would be. Yeah. So we're like, all right, cool. The day later, we come bring it to you. And you're like, I think I might be able to get this past them. And you spoke to the BBC and you're like, yeah, Japan, sweet. Like, yes, amazing.
It was... The film was actually a bit like the TV show from where I was sitting, is that there were moments where it felt like it was nearly not going to happen.
Yeah.
Mm. We had quite a narrow, I think a couple of you were busy on other things, or Steve Stamp, who we should give a huge mention to.
Yes.
He's a major engine in the success of this show. Yeah. I think I remember being cross because he was doing other things, and I was like, you know, and he didn't have long to write this, and the first draft wasn't quite right, and focus features were going, well, where is the script? And I was going, you know, and they were like, well, if we don't like the script, you won't get the money to go to Japan, and the script wasn't right. And I remember there was a few months where I was like, this isn't joining up here. And then I think Steve Stamp came available again, and I'm in my office now at home, and I'm looking at my dining room table. I remember spending hours and hours there on the script, and we sort of just got it there. They I don't think we would get the money now with what's happened in the world.
Oh man, we're so lucky. Yeah. Do you know what just popped into my head? Coming doing the script at your house and having a lasagna. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a highlight. So, probably highlight of the film writing process. That's just lasagna.
I because you like the lasagna in the show, and I just thought, what would be a funny food to give Seifer when he comes around to my house, and that's all I had.
Amazing.
If anything, remember me as the lasagna guy.
Yeah.
Captain Lasagna.
Yeah.
But no, that film was a real, you know, touch and go thing for a moment. But anyway, like the rest of this series, it seemed to have had a charmed life.
Yeah, for sure, man. And for everyone listening, it's meant to come out last year. It's ready. It's in the bag. Well, they call it in the can.
In the can.
Yeah, bag sounds better though.
In the bag. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
More drug dealing sort of vibe.
Like weed.
Exactly. Yeah. So it should be coming out this August, right? As touch wood, if everything goes to plan.
I believe it's a mid-August. It's a mid-August release, and I think, you know, it's actually pretty good. The film, you know, it's another thing. It's like, you sort of look at yourselves and go, it's really all right.
Yeah,
it's another example of you guys sort of getting a little bit better again. Incredible.
Yeah, I believe so, man. Like,
I hope so.
Say it sick, sure. Hugo.
Say it sick, Hugo.
It's really fucking good. I'm proud of it. Genuinely, I'm proud of it, and it's better than what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Where does it compare to The Godfather for you, Hugo?
Oh, fucking hell. Definitely better than the third.
Godfather is boring. Takes ages to get into.
Yeah, innit? Yeah.
Instant.
So, anyway, make sure you lot check out the film this August, hopefully. Hopefully in brackets. And it's a sick one, man. Ash, that's come towards the end of your journey. What's the future of TV, man? Like with everything that's going on, you can see more what's happening behind the scenes or whatever. Has it affected things? Is it going to change things?
I think the future is really optimistic, actually. I think people are watching more of it than ever. I think the sort of streaming gold rush is, funny enough, talking about the film, I'm glad I'm not entirely in this film industry. I think that probably does have some long-term challenges. People's TVs have got bigger at home.
Yeah.
The choice, you know, I still get, you know, I got into bed last night, honestly, and I was looking for something to watch. I just still, like a child, get bewildered at the amount of choice that is just in my little silver screen in front of me. It's nothing, you know, and this is in the last 5 years. And so people talk about all the changes in television a lot at the moment, but actually for what I do and for what you do, it's the same, right? We get to make shows. I think the kind of shows, you know, if we were making a show together now, I would see if we could come up with something maybe a little bit more international in focus, because the world has in a sense got smaller, and the shows that we make here, it's good if they are popular in America and in Europe as well. That's what
And it seems like if this whole, you know, I was about to go this whole internet thing kicked off.
It did actually kick off in
It did. I thought it was gonna be a fad that blows over. No, but with this, you know, with the whole, I guess, internet generation, we are more one world now, right? You know, before you might get like a real comedy specialist in America that's seen the UK Office or whatever and gets it, because most people are like, oh, Americans don't understand irony and dry comedy, you know, but I feel like that's all changed now. And like you're saying, there's a lot more scope for like more international shows that like cover both sides sort of thing.
Right. Well, you put something on Netflix and it goes to America and it goes around the world. You know, less and less you're going to see people making American versions of UK shows.
Yeah.
Because the UK show will be up in America and we're watching their shows as well. So the world has got smaller, but in terms of TV, actually, there's more and more of it to be made. So we're, I'm glad we didn't keep that job in Blockbusters that I was recommending for us, but in terms of the industry generally, and my mini disc factory has gone.
That one blew over the quickest, didn't it? Mini disc, Jesus.
Mini disc was, DVD was fucking quick when you, if you look back at the world.
Yeah, it's true.
DVD was just like 3 years.
Yeah, and we're still trying to sell them last year.
I've got 90,000 people just in nothing DVDs in a Watford lockup if anyone needs them.
Yeah. Just outside the mini disc factory.
So we're in the right business for once.
Ah, yeah, amazing. Well, that's good news. And so now let's get to the real important parts.
Wow, DJ Ostrich, why you stop the show? Well, I'll tell you, bro, this is the most important part. It's the question everybody wants to know. No, it is not what is your favorite jean fit. No, it is not what is your favorite size inch television. It's what is your favorite sandwich?
Second to last question we ask all our guests is, what's your favourite sandwich?
Great question. So I'm addicted to sandwiches. I love sandwiches.
Oh, wow.
I take them really seriously. So I like...
I'll tell you what then, Ash, because I love it when I get like an excited response. Sandwich. I want a top three from you, top three.
Okay, so I like... So at three, I'll go some sort of tuna mix. Maybe like a tuna sambal, coconut, chili,
lemon juice,
sort of freshly sort of chopped onion, something like that. At number two, I'm going to go like a chicken escallop.
Round of applause for that one.
Chicken escallop.
Nice.
And then number one, we can take a little bit of time on this. So it would be something like a spicy salami with andouille.
Yes.
And then like a pecorino cheese and some vinaigrette, fresh chilies, onions. And then I don't really like bread. Bread is just to bring the sandwich food to my mouth. Yeah. So sometimes just a thin bit of bread or even with one, the top bit of the bread gone.
Oh, like an open sandwich.
Nice. Like an IKEA sandwich.
Yeah. Give me an IKEA sandwich.
Standy style. Yeah. That's sick.
So that's my top three.
Yeah, they're strong contenders, man.
Yes, I'm starving.
Thank you. I'm really pleased you like them.
Right. Now for the real important part of the show, because it's you asking us questions. And that's what anyone cares about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Finally. Right,
this is what we call the three questions. And it is where you have to ask me and Hugo three questions each. They can be the same question if they relate to both of us, or they can be a question each.
Same question to both of you. What has been the time that you've been the most embarrassed in my presence?
Oh, God, okay.
Stitch up!
I'm doing your podcast, mate.
Yeah. I know what you're getting. You always bring this up, yeah? I think there's one time where I was with John and Ash and I were at a pub and there were stairs and Ash wanted, or someone was like, someone grabbed Ash to go up the stairs and I didn't jump forward to do it because I was nervous. I'd never done it before and I didn't want to fucking fuck it up. But Ash then always thought I hated disabled people till this day. It's not true.
Wheelchair beta, wheelchair hater.
No, but Ash, since then we've had many moments where we're both intertwined with you and the wheelchair and me. What about you, Hugo?
Mine's not as funny, but I remember the BBC were on set and you were like, the BBC are here, like, make sure you're on point today, make sure you kill it. And
just to explain to people, the BBC will do a set visit where they sit behind them, watch the monitors and have headphones on and can hear everything you're saying on the mics.
And I was doing a scene with Asim and I just kept fucking up and it just wasn't good. And finally we got it done probably after about 50 takes. And then, I just felt tiny afterwards. And then Asim carried on and he was killing it. And they were all crying with laughter, clapping. Yeah. I was like, oh, they fucking hate me. That's probably mine.
Roll back into the room, they don't even look you in the eye.
Show might be better without him, but anyway.
Yeah.
That's how I felt.
All right, question two.
Have either of you taken hard drugs on set? I don't think we can't really count weed because you're always stoned, so...
Oh, I was going to say, I'll tell you something. No, I haven't. I haven't taken hard drugs on set. But what I've done is, on the pilot, And even for the listeners out there, even drinking or smoking weed would technically be illegal on set because of insurance issues. So on the pilot, I was shitting myself so much. There was one scene, and it's nothing comparing to the scenes we have to do now, but one scene where I had to be like angry and excitable rather than just like, yes, bruv, you know, doing a talking head or whatever. Do you know what I mean? And it was when we're doing a pilot radio set, and I was really like nervous to like, you know what I mean? Do this like fucking weird emceeing in front of like, cameramen and that of different generation that have got no clue what I'm talking about. So I ended up literally running into a store cupboard, getting someone to get me a can of Stella, and just backed the can of Stella and then ran in, grabbed the mic and started doing
it. Fucking, you know, it's well easy.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. MCing, yeah.
Hugo, you've done a few. Am I right in saying you've regretfully like had a little blaze or something and been like,
yeah, we were filming near my house and I had like a 6-hour gap and I was like, oh, I'll go home, smoke a spliff, by the time I go back to set it'd be fine. And then they called me like an hour later and were like, yeah, we need you to come down, thing is coming for you now. And I was like, oh fuck. And then I just fucked the scene up, just took ages, couldn't learn my, like, couldn't get my lines right, and then I'd never done it again since.
I was gonna say, do you remember the time at the GQ Awards where we were sitting at a table and Hugo had what do they call it?
Like a little THC.
Oh, the weed pen.
Yeah.
Like a vape pen. And but I didn't know it had weed in it, or I didn't know how strong the weed in it. And
oh,
I
was, man.
You did know it had it in it, so you're like, give that here.
Go on, give it.
Give that here. But I remember it sent me so fucking off key. I started to talk to Anthony Joshua and Liam Gallagher behind us, and they were like, who is this cunt? Remember?
I remember that. Yeah,
those things are powerful, man.
And Pele was there. Do you remember Pele was there in a wheelchair? And I was like, I went up and made it. I wanted a Robot Wars picture.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Both the wheelchairs, and his management said no from the waist upwards. We know what you're like.
Oh, that is amazing.
Okay, final question. Tell me about the time either of you have sent a text or a WhatsApp to the wrong person and it's been catastrophic. They're like, I know what you like, I like the girls, you've got millions of girlfriends, you always...
Hugo.
Yeah, I'm trying to think myself of something like that.
Oh, okay, I've got another story. I've got a similar like type of, same essence of story. When I was single, like a few years ago, like, you know, like whatever, 5 years ago, this girl, my date, this girl was like WhatsApping me and it's, you know, it was getting like, you know, it's getting a little bit whatever, you know what I mean? A little bit.
No, would you?
All right, okay.
A little bit heated.
Yeah, it's getting a bit heated, yeah. What were you getting angry at? No, not heated like that. Jesus.
Baby.
Yeah, I wanted to see her, and I didn't have her on Instagram, so I wanted to see her, like, her WhatsApp picture just to, like, look at her face. And back then it was right next to the call button. So I pressed it and it started calling her. I was like, shit. Turned off, and she was like, what are you doing? Were you trying to look at my picture? I was like, no, I called the fucking thing. I called the thing. Anyway, I've got to go. I got weird and left.
I'm trying to think of my, I guess I've, when I was younger, had an ex-girlfriend and I drunkenly, I'm sure loads of people have done this, thought now is a good time to call her. Yeah, and I've called her and a man's picked up the phone and gone, hello? I'm like, oh,
put her on. Tell her
I'm
on
BBC Three now. Put her on.
Who's this? Who's this? What's she, what are you doing?
It's not Hugo, it's Beats.
Yeah. I've changed my name.
Right, on that note, Ash, you've been an amazing guest, man. Thank you so much for your time,
brother. Thank you very much.
And round of applause for the almighty Ash Atala.
My absolute pleasure, boys. Really enjoyed doing this. Thank you. Hey, guys, same. We should keep in touch.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
We've got to go anyway. See ya.
No. Guys, who's coming out for a drink tonight? No.
This is the outro. See you later. And good luck. Stay lucky, boy. Stay lucky, boy.
What a man, eh?
Yeah, man.
Puts you to shame, you little prick.
Yeah, it puts us all to shame, I think.
No, especially when he described how I conduct myself in meetings. It's actually made me think about it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he has spent 10 years with you quite intensely. So.
Yeah, Poor bastard.
I think anyone that spends that amount of time with you.
Yeah, I mean, I broke you years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, do you know what? It was sick hearing his journey, man, because like, I guess you take for granted when you see someone all the time, but hearing like where he came from and his journey is pretty mental,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, it's true.
We've known him for 10 years and we're good mates with him. We didn't know all those things, do you know what I mean?
I never knew he was a stockbroker.
Yeah.
Because I always assume people that get into TV are from the world of TV.
Yeah, or that they take the glass of the front bit of the TV and climb into their telly.
They shrink themselves, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a clone, yeah. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you would have thought. You would have thought.
Mad when you think about it.
Yeah, exactly. But no, shout out Ash, man.
Yeah.
We only skimmed the surface of all the amazing things he's done in his life. He's worked on so many shows. But yeah, I hope you lot found that interesting. And yeah, man, check out all his work, especially People Do Nothing.
Yeah, if you haven't already, watch all of it.
Yeah, if you haven't already, and for some reason, I'm really into these guys because they're just really good presenters.
Yeah,
have they done a TV show?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Check it out on Netflix, iPlayer.
Yeah, all right. Nice one. Anyway, see you shit munchers in a bit.
See you later.
Slater. Hello, mate. Completely forgot to ask you. Are you our new best mate?
Are we best friends? What are you, 8? No, we're not best friends. I agreed to do this podcast. Now leave me alone. All right? This is it. Thanks.
Hey, yo! Will everyone shut the fuck up? I want to give a crazy, stupid, dope fly shout out to everyone involved in this podcast.
No, fuck that. Who's the brain that produces this show, man?
Man like Rupert Magendie.
And who's the audio editor?
James Torrance, check
it. House. Who's the video editor?
Ha ha, James Lord.
And who does all the illustrations?
It's Alison the Ink.
Mad on the visuals, bruh.
Shout out all the posse down at ACAS Laboratory. Hip-hop, am I right, hustler?
You're not wrong, Playboy Valentino.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.